The following program is brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities. The opinions expressed by the members of CFCI and their guests should not be construed as specific investment, legal, or tax advice, and all economic and performance information is historical and not indicative of future results. Investing may involve the risk of loss of principal. Any tax advice on the show is not intended to be used by any person for the purpose of avoiding U.S. federal or state tax, and penalties may be imposed on such persons, and each listener should seek advice from their own tax advisor, legal counsel on topics that arise from the show. The representatives of CFCI and their guests are not providing legal or tax advice. Nothing should be construed as a solicitation to offer or buy securities. Now enjoy the show. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the big show, Your Money with David Hayes. Appreciate you hanging out with me on this Thursday night. Of course, Saturday mornings are my favorite time to listen to the show. And last Saturday, I was live in the studio. I want to say thank you to everyone who went out and supported Lemonade Day. It was a great day for a lot of kids, a lot of young entrepreneurs. In fact, I know for a fact that people listening to the show went to some stands specifically because of that. So it makes me very, very happy, and I appreciate it a great deal. Got a great show today. Rod Holloway will be joining us in just a little bit as we talk about the Fed's decision to move or not to move. Eric Geisler is going to be joining us as well to talk about the world's experiment with negative interest rates. You know, what are they doing? What are they trying to accomplish? And who's actually participating? And more importantly, is it likely to work? And then later on, I'm going to talk about how patience is the key. We're in this somewhat, we would call it a secular bull market. And we're going to have Rod explain what that means. And it's not uncommon to go through these sideways patterns that we're seeing us in right now and how long you can expect that to continue. So that'll be a nice segment as well. And then questions of the week. Had a great question. Hey, I haven't heard you talk about Greece lately. Is that still a problem? Yes, it is. We're going to talk about that. And then also, how do you determine how much you need to replace in retirement, which is part of the news of the week as well. News of the week brought to you by Bloomington Affordable Self-Storage. Reclaim the clutter areas of your home with help from Bloomington Affordable Self-Storage. It's over on 17th Street, newly remodeled, 24-hour on-site management, offering truck rentals too. Call 812-339-4221. It's a beautiful facility. I just was by there today. Hey, did you see this? West Texas Intermediate crude oil hit $50 a barrel on Thursday. That's a 92% gain from the bottom of February 11th. But how well did your mutual fund or exchange-traded funds fare in this 2016 rally? It really depends on how badly they got clobbered in that epic collapse. West Texas crude made this most recent peak back on June 20th of 2014. It actually peaked out, believe it or not, at $107.95 a barrel. From top to bottom, the old black gold took a plunge, clocking a 75.7% loss. Big, big deal. Funds that invested in oil and gas pipelines also got their pipes cleaned. When most people felt, and including yours truly, that MLPs would fare much better, I should say, when oil reduced the price, or the price of oil went down, but they didn't. They got clobbered just as well. Big losses. Here's the things we can take away from oil's wild ride so far. Number one, big losses are very tough to recover from. Two, commodities are insanely difficult to predict. Three, active management can sometimes help. And then bargain hunting can pay off. I had a good buddy that said, Hayes, we need to buy all we can of this energy stocks. And I kept saying, man, I think we still have some downward pressure. And we did. And he's now still pretty excited about buying as much as you possibly can. The bottom line is, have a good reason for putting your money into a highly speculative sector anytime. You know, commodities have traditionally been viewed as a way to reduce volatility in an equity portfolio as well as an inflation hedge. But you better have very good instincts when it comes to that stuff. And I'll tell you, it was hard. And I got sucked in. You know, oil was down at $50 a barrel. It's like, man, everyone's predicting 80. And you just go in and, you know, you get burnt sometimes. So always be careful. June 24, 2014 high point, actually more than 40 U.S. companies in the oil industry have filed for bankruptcy. That comes from Bloomberg. Here's a piece from Investment News. Retirees need 70% of their pre-retirement income, but most live on a lot less. Most financial planners say that you need 70% of your pre-retirement income when you retire to live the same way that you do now, according to Bankrate.com. But nationwide, retirees are averaging 60.37% of their pre-retirement income. The numbers include everything: wages, salaries, tips, Social Security, and welfare. I'm not one of these guys. I'm more of a bottoms-up guy. We're going to talk about that in questions of the week, but how you can kind of get to the same point using a top-down or bottom-down approach. But, you know, a lot of times you don't need 70%. Maybe 60% is okay because you don't have a mortgage. But then mainly people are really missing this piece, also from Investment News. A new report projecting healthcare costs for current and future retirees is just chock full of scary numbers that would keep most people like myself up at night as we try to prepare our clients for retirement. The HealthView Retirement Health Cost Data Report also challenges traditional financial planning methods by using the income replacement ratio I just talked about to determine how much you need to maintain your standard of living in retirement without factoring in realistic health care costs and appropriate health care inflation that you could be under saving for in real retirement income needs analysis. HealthView Sciences or Services data showed the average healthy 65-year-old couple retiring this year is projected to spend $288,000 in today's dollars on lifetime Medicare Part B, D, and supplement insurance premiums when typical out-of-pocket costs for services not covered by Medicare like vision, dental, hearing are included. The couple's total retirement health care bill jumps up to over $377,000. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Rod Holloway as we talk about the Fed's decision coming up in June, what's going to push them one way or another, and also how the strengthening dollar has pushed down commodity prices for sure, with the exception of oil having somewhat of a bump. But the equity markets have seemed to shrug it off for the most part. We'll take a break. We'll come back with Rod Holloway. This is Your Money with David Hayes. You know, in the most recent Wall Street Journal survey of economists, they show that the experts were pretty much split on this matter of whether the Fed will raise rates in June or not. 31.4% predicting a June increase, 21% favoring a July hike, 31.4% forecasting a September hike. And Rod Holloway joins us now live on the radio. And Rod, you know, for the most part, I don't know that it even makes a difference anymore, but sometimes when they say, okay, it's a 100% chance or 90% chance that the Fed will raise, and then weeks before they meet, oh, no, there's no chance they're going to raise rates again. How is this, from the equity market standpoint, how do you see this verbiage and just this talk affecting the equity markets right now?
You know, I think the effect on the equity markets has been greatly diminished because, of course, this talk has been going on for a number of years. In the very beginning stages, anytime there was talk of either the reduction or taking away of one of the quantitative easing programs, or after they were done and any discussions about possibly beginning to start rising increasing interest rates and allowing it to normalize, as they say, early on it created some volatility and some angst in the market. But I think the market has started to settle down. It's less reactionary to some of the comments that come out. As we have talked about for a long time, if the Fed truly does begin the tightening cycle and raising rates, it typically should mean it's a positive sign because they think the economy is doing well. They no longer need to artificially prop it up with any of their policies that they are implementing. So I think the market, while early, was very nervous about that. I think it's settling in. You may see a few days in which there is some reaction to things that are going on, or sometimes on the day that one of the Fed presidents come out and he gives his opinion on what he thinks should happen at the next meeting, you may get an immediate reaction, but it doesn't seem to be a reaction that lasts much longer than that day or maybe a day or two in it.
It seems like when they are more certain that they will raise rates, the dollar will strengthen. Obviously, the world, and we're going to talk to Eric about this in a little bit, are trying to devalue their currencies, but it strengthens. That pushes down commodity prices, with the exception of oil. I mean, it's kind of got a little different thing going on right now. But that typically does put some pressure on the overall equity market when you have a strengthening dollar. So that would be something that people could expect to see if this happens, correct?
Yeah, to a certain degree. But the reality is, long-term, what's really going to drive the stock market is the fundamentals of the individual companies. Now, obviously, the global companies who have to deal with currency issues because they are selling all over the world and they have to exchange those currencies into dollars for those transactions have a larger impact on those companies than others. But when you look around the United States and you look at a small company that is only doing business in the Midwest or maybe only here in the U.S. as a whole, but not dealing with it as far as any international or global sales, it has much less of an effect on them. So really what people are looking for, hey, are your earnings per share growing, and at what rate are they growing? Are your sales increasing? Are you able to maintain the margins that you have had, or even hopefully increase your margins on each product or service that you're selling? That's the long-term driving force behind it. So it's not that the dollar has no impact. It has an impact. But just like the Fed rate increase that we're discussing of 0.25%, many of these things that get talked about over and over and over will have some effect, but the effect long-term is much less than what you're led to believe based on the media coverage.
And the labor market obviously is going to play a major role in the Fed's decision in June. The April's job report, Rod, came out softer than expected. The May's job report comes out June 3rd. That'll be a key to showing whether the labor market has returned into a stronger trend or continue to weaken, and that would be a big reason the Fed would move one way or another. So they're going to continue to talk about this stuff all the way through what is June 3rd, next week, actually.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing with the jobs number, I think really the only thing that would impact a near-term move if they're ready to make it in June was if you had an extremely weak number, something down in the low hundreds or even below 100,000. Because for the most part, the Fed is really looking at the long-term trend. There's not one monthly number that is going to push them to take action one way or another. So if they would get an anomaly number that is completely out of the norm of what we have been seeing in the trend here recently, that may cause them to take pause and say, hey, wait a minute, is this a one-off, or is this the beginning of a new trend that we did not anticipate? If you came in with a hot jobs number and it was much higher, it would cause them to consider the move a little bit quicker. But here's what I believe really is going to happen. The Fed has basically said they're ready to make another race. Now, does that happen in June, July, or September? As you said with the statistics, a lot of people are guessing, and the numbers are all over the board as to when that rate will happen, but I think they've painted themselves into the corner that they want to raise at least one more time. Of course, a few Fed presidents have said probably two or three more times. I'd be surprised at three. I expect one. I'm not sure about two.
Britain's upcoming vote on whether to leave the EU, that might give the Fed enough reason to pause. It's likely to be a lively June meeting at the Fed, I guess, if you're into that kind of stuff, being a fly on the wall. But volatility, folks, is expected to continue in the days and weeks ahead as analysts fixate on predicting whether they're going to move or not. But it's just remember, it's really important to not let these intraday swings or daily bumps in the road derail your long-term investment strategies. Because, Rod, real quick, because we have Eric in the batter's box here ready to go. We have been talking about, I know some of the guys that you follow are talking about this being a secular bull market, and then sometimes you go through periods of sideways motion in a secular bull market. I'm going to talk about that later on in the program, but would you just explain to people what a secular bull market actually is?
Sure. Secular bull market's no different than what we just talked about with the jobs number looking at the long-term trend. And that's what a secular bull market is that you're looking at a long-term trend in which the market continues to slowly, well, not always slowly, but continue to move up. But in that period of moving up, you can go sideways. You can even have a negative year in which the market goes down. The most recent secular bull market, of course, we had was 87 until the tech bubble bursting in the first quarter of 2000. If you go back and look at individual year numbers from 87 to 2000, not every single year was up. Not every single year was up big in double digits. But if you look at the overall trend and the majority of those years, they were positive and continuing to move forward, and that's what the secular bull market is, a long-term trend. But within that long-term trend, you can have some counter trends. The big long-term trend just doesn't get broken.
Rod Holloway, the portfolio manager over at CFCI. Thank you, Rod. We'll see you bright and early in the morning.
Okay. Have a great rest of the show, Dave, and I'll talk to you tomorrow morning.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Eric Giesler, our fixed income manager, will be joining me. This world's experiment with negative interest rates. Why are they doing it? What are they trying to accomplish? Who is participating? And is it unlikely to work? We'll be back with Eric Giesler, the bond guru himself. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes and back-to-back performances. Eric Giesler joins me on the telephone. And before we get to Eric, you know, as we look at the interest rate environment, I mean, let's just put this in perspective real quick. Here in the U.S., the Federal Reserve remains committed, as Rod said, to raising the federal funds rate. And that's basically a benchmark that could affect interest rates on consumer credit. But abroad, a different experiment is underway. As of late 2016, six foreign central banks have adopted negative interest rates in an effort to stimulate their national economies. The list includes the European Central Bank, Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, Hungary, Japan. And when you take all those economies together, they represent about one-fourth of global output. So it's a pretty big deal. So the question is, why would central banks lower interest rates, especially into negative territory? Well, number one, they're trying to encourage consumer spending and business investing by making it really cheap to borrow and hold lucrative cash or less lucrative cash. The second reason, lower the value of the national currency in order to make their exports more appealing and to create an expectation of future inflation, which may further spending down the road. And then this really confuses everybody, and Eric mentioned this last week that we're in uncharted territory because it reverses the traditional economic concept by turning a borrower into a creditor and a creditor into a borrower. And that's because the commercial banks are going to actually lose money on their short-term deposits at the central bank. Eric Giesler, our fixed income manager and partner of mine over at CFCI, now joins me on the phone. And Eric, we talked about this some last week that we're in some uncharted territories, and that's why folks try to go into low interest rate environments. That's who's participating. My real question to you is this likely to work?
Well, I don't think it has up to this point. And I don't think we see any real evidence. It's been tried before. Japan certainly has tried it before. But I think one of the things that comes about is that you actually get forces that you would not expect, because if a government or a central bank decides to go to negative interest rates, that causes desperation to kind of creep into people's thinking, and people hoard their money even more rather than spending more.
They'll put it underneath their mattress.
I think the psychology is almost reversed from what they're hoping will happen.
Now, I would also say it's very hard to create demand. You know, Eric, if interest rates were 2%, would you, at this point in your life, go out and borrow money against your home to then turn around and do something crazy with it? I would say no. I just don't think you can create demand. And when you look at the demographics of Europe, they're much older than even here in the U.S., so I just don't see the demand being created no matter how cheap they make their money over there.
And I agree. As a matter of fact, some of because the bank is paying customers to borrow money, they're having to charge the people that deposit the money. So once again, for all of the help that you think you're bringing to the table, at the same time you're kind of hurting yourself because depositors are becoming upset because they're having to pay to put their money in the bank, so to speak.
And we talked about this last week as well, but that has also contributed to keeping our domestic interest rates pretty low, because the 10-year treasury under 2%, the 30-year treasury under 3%. So, you know, it's making our money still very cheap to borrow. It's making lump sum retirement accounts look pretty good. If you're in a defined benefit plan and they calculate your lump sum based on how old you are in the current interest rate environment, people are smiling ear to ear right now. They're going to be able to walk away with big lump sums. But then I always caution people, what are you going to do with that money once you get it? It's a little difficult to find some yield out there.
Well, and I think that's it. You know, because in this country, certainly businesses have, and I think even individuals have begun the tendency to kind of hold on to their cash while they wait to see if the economy or interest rates are going to pick up. And so far, we haven't seen that.
And there's a cost to waiting, Eric. If you sit around and wait by putting money just in cash, as opposed to accepting a low yield of 2%, 2.5%, 3%, and you miss 2 or 3 years of that, and then you finally decide, okay, I'm going to go ahead and do it, because we could, then you've lost out on some opportunity. So I would encourage people to not invest based on these low interest rates, but to be smart about it, maintain a laddered approach possibly, or find someone who's really good like you.
I would go back to your conversation with Rod. Have a plan and stick to it. Do not get caught up in what central banks are doing or the Fed is doing, but have a plan and stick to it, and generally those over the long run work out a lot better than trying to either address what the Fed is doing or whether the central banks are charging negative interest rates. I think you just have to have a plan and stick to it.
Turn the TV off. Quit reading the newspapers. That's the best advice I can give. Although I have been watching more television at night, more news than I ever have, probably because of the political season that we're in. And it seems like, you know, nothing good comes of that. I mean, it just doesn't give you a positive outlook on anything. And it scares people. They do irrational things. And like you said, don't base what you heard on the news the night before or read on some crazy email or website to say, I'm going to shift all my money today. Because over time, if you stick to a strategy, and this is you know, stuff that we've messed up on before, so that's how we know that if you continue to chase that rabbit, change strategies based on how you feel, you normally don't have things work out the way you want them to work out. So Eric had it
right
on the head.
Good
have
advice.
A plan, stick to it, and that's it. So Eric, you're going to have a good weekend this weekend, Memorial
you
Day
too.
Weekend. It's going
to
be a
all
good
right,
one.
All right, we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Okay, man. See ya.
Bye.
Eric Geisler, he is our bond guru over at CFCI, probably one of the most conservative people that I know, and sometimes we don't see eye to eye on everything, which is the way you want things, but we usually get it worked out. So Eric Geisler, appreciate him being on the show 2 weeks in a row. That's pretty impressive for Big E. Hey, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the patience that is required when you're in a market like this. Rod mentioned it. He believes that we're in a secular bull market. We've been in one for now some time. And even during secular bull markets, you can go sideways, you can go down in any given period. But I want to give you folks just some perspective on this. You know, we're in a pretty lengthy time frame now where we've been in somewhat of a sideways market. It was May of last year where we peaked out on the S&P 500, according to By the Numbers. So I want to give you a little perspective and how this could last for some time in the future, 10, maybe even 20 months, according to history. So when we come back, we'll give you a little history lesson on how patience is the key. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Another special thanks to Bloomington Affordable Self-Storage for teeing back up their sponsorship here on the radio station. Reclaim the clutter areas of your home with help from Bloomington Affordable Self-Storage over on 17th Street. Look for the big tiger head. Newly remodeled, 24-hour on-site management. They offer truck rentals too. Call them 339-4221. You know, we are now in a period of time where we've gone pretty much sideways in the market for quite some time. And you start to wonder, is this going to continue? Is it going to go up from here, down from here? Well, no one really knows. But as Rod and I have talked a lot about this at the office, we'll rely on some pretty smart people to give us information as well. Got some information from Raymond James recently, and we were talking about the history of sideways movements during secular bull markets, which they believe that we are in. So I thought I'd give you some data points to encourage you to have a little bit of patience, which we seem to have very little of these days. But nonetheless, we'll give you this information. Hopefully, it works. There was some secular bull markets that we looked at. We looked at 1950 through 67. We looked at 19, let's see. We also looked at 1979 through 99. And then we looked at another one as well, 87 through 1990. Let's see. Well, we looked at three different ones, but I'll give you the info. So as a history lesson goes, where sideways movements are concerned for the stock market, I think there was a movie called Sideways as well, but I didn't really see that. But for those of you that think, okay, you can tell me all this, but things are much worse now than way back then, I want you to consider this. Back in the time frame 1951 to 1953, and that was during a secular bull market that lasted from 50 to 67, we had a lot of things going on. The U.S. government seized the steel mills back then to avert a union strike. Eisenhower was elected and then ordered wage controls. Russia exploded an H-bomb. A lot of stuff was going on. Then that same secular bull market, 1959 through 62, the time frame really wasn't much better. We had a U.S. U-2 spy plane that was shot down over Russia. Castro seized all the U.S. oil refineries back in Cuba. East Germany built the wall. That seems like a common phrase these days, too. And the U.S. Military started the conflict in Vietnam. And then also President Kennedy, we had a steel crisis then, and it basically lopped off 28% of the stock market in just a few weeks. And all of that occurred during what people now look back and say was a secular bull market. Then, as for the 1987 to 1990 time frame, which was also in the midst of a pretty big bull market, Rod just talked about that as well, we had several things happen. We had that 1987 crash that many people who had money invested remember. We had a guy named Drexel Burnham. He was charged with insider trading. It was kind of new back then. The Chinese were cracking down on people in Tiananmen Square. Hundreds of banks and thrifts became insolvent. Do you remember the SNL crisis of, this isn't Saturday Night Live, it's actually the savings and loan crisis of 87. That's what actually brought on the Business Development Corporation concept to loan to North American companies, because that was the big financier of North American private companies. And then we also had Iraq invades Kuwait. So when I look back over history, I think, you know, are the problems really that much worse than they are now? What we're probably seeing is a pretty big consolidation, and this is following really a 200% gain in the S&P from March of 2009 through May of 2015. So it's not uncommon, and when you look at some of those periods, these are pretty decent size periods of time. I mean, when you go back and look at that September 51 through October 51, that was 25 months of sideways action. I mean, literally sideways. It was the S&P, believe it or not, back then was 23.48, and it ended 2 years later at 23.97. And then that 59 to 62 time frame, the S&P was around 55 back then. And that's hard to believe. Now it's over 2,000. It ended at 55. That was 39 months of sideways action. And then that 87 to 90 sideways action, the S&P was at 318 and it ended at 315. That was 38 months of action. So if we've been range bound now for about 19 months, it wouldn't be unreasonable to expect another 10 or 20 months of sideways action, just simply based on history. So be patient, you know, keep your money invested, don't freak out, and just understand that we've been here before and that things now obviously seem really bad. I mean, we have some dysfunction going on in the political situation that we find ourselves. We have a lot of terrorism around the world. I mean, you go through it, but then when you look back, and if you've lived through these, you'll know that we've had tough times before. Things maybe are as bad then as they are now. It's just we're living in the now, right? So it's so far ago, you don't feel it as much. I mean, we see that just as being humans all the time. So just keep things in perspective, and like we said, continue to have a goal. Focus on that goal and keep working towards it, and you'll generally make it. Hey, we're going to take another break. When we come back, we'll have questions of the week. Haven't heard much about Greece lately. Someone asked me recently at a talk I gave. Still having troubles, or is that behind us? We also had one on retirement income replacement. I've talked about this briefly in the news of the week, about how 70% of your gross income in retirement should replace it all. We're going to talk about that bottoms-up versus top-down approach in determining that, and then retiree medical costs, being written about a lot lately by our friend Mary Beth Franklin, contributing editor of Investment News and a regular guest here on The Big Show. And then also, if we have time, we'll get to a young person asked me about saving money in their 401k. They have a job. They still have some credit card or debt, I guess, related to student loans, and whether they should focus on student loan reduction first or 401k stuff or both. So we'll get to that as well, and then we'll preview next week's show. We're going to take a quickie. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Questions of the week time here on Your Money with David Hayes. Appreciate you hanging out with us. Saturday mornings, 9 a.m., Thursday nights at 6, and always on WGCLradio.com. Our buddy Jim, who is producing the show, is like a magician when it comes to getting the show up on GCL, WGCLradio.com, because occasionally, not always, in fact, very infrequently, do I go to the website and pull up the show. But last week I did, because I wanted to re-listen to a segment that I wasn't sure was communicated properly. But it was fine. And then I was reminded of the outstanding time that I had at the Mecum Auctions a week and a half ago when I sold my 1942 Chevy Coupe. That was a lot of fun, and still on YouTube if you want to check it out. But it just, that whole excitement of that, it kind of got me jacked back up again when it comes to that. And in fact, I was driving down College Avenue and I took a right to come to the station, and there was a 1958 classic car sitting there, beautiful. And I kept looking, is it for sale? Don't let me buy another car. It was a one-hit wonder. That was it. I had a good time. Next time, it probably won't turn out quite as good. Questions of the week. All right. I was speaking to a group of folks, and they said, hey, I haven't heard about Greece lately. Are you still having troubles, or is everything you know, behind them, or is just everything else going on overshadowing it? Well, yeah, there's still problems over there. In fact, Rodney Johnson, our friend at the HS Dent organization, again, a regular contributor to the big show, wrote a nice piece called Third Time's a Charm. And he made a really good point. You know, if you lend a guy money and then he didn't pay you back, would you lend it to him a second time? What about a third time? I mean, I've been silly enough to loan money to people, and now I don't loan money. If you need money, I'll just give you money if I want to, but I'm not going to loan it to you, because then when you drive up in that new car and haven't repaid me, it makes me mad. You parents understand exactly what I'm talking about. But then what about a third time? I mean, but that's exactly what's going on in Europe. And the European Central Bank, European Commission, and the IMF, all three of those entities collectively, they've bailed out Greece in 2010, again in 2012. All told, Greece has received 216 billion euros. That's almost equal to dollars, actually a little bit more than dollars. And they defaulted on a chunk of debt to private investors. And now the Greeks are back at the bailout door again, hoping to finalize the deal before their next debt payment is due on July 1st. Sounds really familiar, eh? The ECB and the EU have agreed to more austerity issues in Greece in exchange for just under another 100 billion euros of bailout bucks. But the IMF is holding out because the officials at the IMF are saying, we don't think Greece can make good on these new promises, and I'm probably in the same boat. They want remaining creditors like the ECB and the central banks across Europe to discount their Greek bonds instead of asking for budget cuts for the ailing country. But my question is, and Rodney's question is also, what difference does it really make? I mean, even though Greek lawmakers agreed to more spending cuts and higher taxes over the weekend, it doesn't really change the facts that they're broke. I mean, the country generates actually a very small primary surplus, meaning that it has a little bit of cash left over before it pays its principal and interest on its debt. But the country owes more than 370 billion euros. That's like you saying, okay, I have a little bit of cash left over, but I haven't yet paid my mortgage or my rent. So that doesn't work very well. And why would the Greeks want more bailout bucks? I mean, the 216 billion euros that they received from the first two rounds, only like 9 billion of it actually got back into their coffers. A chunk of it, 90 billion, just repaid old debt to create new debt. And then the rest flowed back to bondholders in the form of interest payments and some principal pay downs. So for the 126 billion euros of new debt, Greece received like less than 10 billion of fiscal stimulus. Nice, right? I mean, who wants that kind of deal? But on the other hand, you know, they have no choice. I mean, they must force another bailout because all of the Greek bonds are owned by the central banks, and they're owned by central banks all across Europe. So if they default, I mean, that's a big deal and a problem, and no one in the Eurozone wants that. These problems are not going away anytime soon. They will pop their head back up. It will create issues in the markets. But for right now, there are other things that have overshadowed it. So basically, I'm just telling you that most of the money, actually 25% of the budget in Greece, goes to pay pension payments. And more people are joining those ranks every single day, as I mentioned earlier. Very aging population, older than America. So the country's already bankrupt. It's just a matter of time when everyone acknowledges the fact and they start working on some real solutions. I don't know what those are. But until then, expect more bailouts and band-aids as they try to keep Greece afloat so the European Union doesn't splinter. And, of course, there's the shockwaves right now of the potential that the Brits bail on them as well. All right, had another question from a listener on the retirement income replacement rules. They said, I heard that I need to replace about 70% of what I make to have a comfortable retirement. Is that what you tell people too? The answer is no, but it's a good rule of thumb. And here's why. What I like to do is take your take-home income. You know, what is your take-home income? And what is it that you spend that money on? Are some things going away? Are we going to have some additions down the road? But the bottom line, I take the take-home income, and then I put taxes on top of that, so that your take-home income plus taxes actually ends up working out pretty close to about 70% of your gross in most cases. So as an example, let's say your gross is $6,000 a month. That's $72,000 a year. 70% of $6,000 is $4,200 a month. Now, for most people that make $6,000 a month gross, they don't bring home even close to that. They bring home about 50 to 60% of it because you're putting money in your 401k, you're paying your federal and state tax, you might have some union dues, you might be giving money to, you know, some charity, but you also are paying FICA and the FUTA taxes as well, 7.65%. So that all comes out. Then you get your paycheck, right? So let's say that you make about 60% of or bring home about 60%. That ends up being about $3,600. So then if I add taxes on top of that, that means you need to gross maybe $4,500 a month, something like that. So whenever you look at 70% of $6,000 is $4,200, or you take your net take home and then add your taxes, you end up in about the same place. So 70% for someone who doesn't really want to do the work yet and determining and really nailing down on that number that you're going to need, then 70% is probably a good rule of thumb. But I don't like to do that. I like to use the bottoms up approach with using net income, not the top down. But here's one of the biggies, and we talked about this in the news of the week section. Even after you do that and you determine, okay, this is how much gross I need, this is how much Social Security I have coming in, this is how much pension if I'm fortunate to have one, and then this is how much I need from investments. Oh, I have enough money, great. Don't forget to add in for medical expenses. I've been doing this lately because a new report, and this came from Investment News, a new report projecting healthcare costs for current and future retirees is just chocked full of these scary numbers that would keep most people up at night and kept me up at night as a financial planner, because I was thinking, okay, for 20 years, I haven't really been planning for this. I didn't know about it enough, and no one told us about it to be able to help people prepare. But now I'm seeing it in real life unfold as retirees are in their 80s that used to be in their 60s when I first started working with them. So this HealthView Retirement Health Cost Data report came out. It really is challenging the traditional planning methods of using the income replacement ratio that I just talked about, 70%, to determine how much you're going to need to maintain your standard of living without factoring in the realistic healthcare cost and the cost of healthcare inflation that you will be under, I'll be under, when it comes to saving for our real retirement income needs. So this HealthView Services data shows the average healthy 65-year-old couple retiring in this year is projected to spend $288,000 over their lifetime on Medicare Part B, which usually comes out of your Social Security check, D, which is usually like your drug plan, and then supplemental insurance premiums as well. When typical out-of-pocket services are also not covered by Medicare, like your vision, dental, hearing aids, things like that, a couple's total retirement health care bill is likely to be over $375,000. Crazy. 33 more thousand than last year was estimated. So you need to put that on top. So when I do a retirement income plan now, we say, okay, after these are my income, this is what I need, this is what I have coming in, this is what I need from investments. And then I'll also say, we also need this money. So if I have, let's say you're fortunate enough to have, you know, a nice nest egg, and I don't want to throw out numbers, but let's just use $1 million. You have $1 million and you need that money to produce some income each and every month. I would go in and say, okay, this $300,000 or $350,000, that is money that I'll probably need for health care cost over my lifetime, and this is really what I have left over for income replacement needs, and it makes the numbers much different. It doesn't mean that they're going to be tremendously higher, but it just puts things sort of in their proper place. And, you know, I'm a big bucket guy, you know, that I like to structure income plans where you have, you know, the now money, the soon money, and the later money, or even bucket income out that's assured for 10 or 15 years to buy yourself time horizon. Does that make sense? You know, most of us press that I believe button that the equity markets will perform well over time. Well, how long? Is it 10 years? Is it 15? Is it 20? Well, if you can assure your income through fixed investments for that first 10 or 15 years, then your later money, you've bought yourself time horizon. So if that bucket kind of gets out of whack, gets a little bit crazy, go through a big crash, yeah, you're not going to like it. It's not going to be fun, but you can keep it in perspective by saying that money I don't need for the next 15 years. So I have a little bit of time to let that thing ride out. So that's the way you should really look at it. Okay, another question, let me get to it here, is trying to figure out if I should put more money in my 401k or focus on paying down my student loan debt. My employer matches 4%, so that's what I put in. If I continue to pay on my student loans as scheduled, it'll take me about 8 more years to pay them off. So I'm 24, single, making about $50,000 a year right now. Congratulations. Certainly probably picked a good field, so that's awesome. And then they're in the single tax bracket, obviously. So here we go. So, you know, is there a right or wrong answer here? I don't necessarily know. But remember this, you're in a single taxpayer bracket, which is the highest taxpayer bracket. You've got the value of time value of money by putting money into your 401k. That's tax deferred as well. There may be some tax benefits to interest that you're paying on your student loans. But here's the other thing. The interest rate on your student loan is fixed, so you know that's a definite. The money that's in your 401k is going to have uneven return expectations. But you can never go wrong, in my opinion, of paying down debt. So you're still saving some in your 401k. That's terrific. You're going to really be able to crank that up in your 30s by focusing on getting this, or once that debt's paid off. So I think you'll be okay either way, but I would go with what makes you feel the best. And I know we are in that world where we do things based on how we feel, so I'm contributing to that. I apologize, but that's what I would do. But I don't think you can go wrong either way. But I would probably, my gut tells me, keep doing the 4%, focus on paying that debt down, try to get it paid down in 3 or 4 years rather than 8, and then turn that money right back around into your 401k and go from there. Does that make sense? Hope it did. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll start to wrap up the big show and preview what next week's show is going to be about. You're going to be excited about it because it's a big-time guest. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Still giving away every single week for the entire month of May, which is running out quickly. The Definitive Guide for Required Minimum Distributions for Baby Boomers from the Ed Slott & Company. And also, we will give you the 5 easy steps to RMDs as well. This is the first year the baby boomers start turning 70 and a half, which is when they have to start taking minimum distributions from the retirement accounts. I had a client who is currently in Minnesota, and she said, hey, husband is going to be 70 and a half. We're talking about maybe qualified charitable distributions. I've read some about it. I've heard you talk about it. Can you send me some information about it so I can read up over the summer? And I sent her the Definitive Guide for Required Distributions and said, hey, it's on page 31. So it's all in there. It's like Prego sauce from the old days. Remember, it's all in there. You guys remember that. So check it out. If you want it, email us at cfci.us. Contact us. I'll email you the Ed Slott Definitive Guide for Required Minimum Distributions for Baby Boomers. And then that brings me to my guest next week, which is scheduled right now as we speak, Mr. Ed Slott himself. He's been on many, many public television specials around the country. He's raised millions of dollars for public television as an advocate, a consumer advocate on retirement planning, tax planning, IRA distributions. Of course, he is the founder of IRAhelp.com. You can check that out as well. And of course, I've been a longtime member and student of Ed, probably, 13, 14 years or something like that. So really looking forward to having Ed on next week. And trust me, he's going to say, David Hayes is the greatest. You need this, you need that. I did not pay him for all those endorsements. So anyway, but hopefully Ed will be able to pull through next week and get on the big show. So everyone have a great Memorial Day weekend. You know, thank a veteran, those especially gave the ultimate sacrifice. And I'll see you at the race on Sunday. Goodbye, everyone. The preceding program was brought to you by Comprehensive Financial Consultants and CFCI, which is solely responsible for its content. Securities are offered through J.W. Cole Financial, member FINRA and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI and J.W. Cole Advisors. J.W. Cole Financial, J.W. Cole Advisors, and CFCI are unaffiliated entities.